Welcome to Tales from the Bridge. This is episode 51, and we are talking about Chris Hadfield's The Apollo Murders. Be sure to stick around to find out what we're reading next, because it's a great handful of books that everyone seems to really like. We take some time to talk about The Rings of Power. We talk about the show a little bit, but also about what's going on with the reviews and everything. Be sure to stick around for some trivia. Right now, let's start talking about some AI art. All right, let's make our way over to the bridge.
So, I don't know what you guys think about some of the weird AI stuff that's coming out, but OpenAI, this initiative that's trying to push forward AI kind of out in the open, it was originally started by Elon Musk, they've come up with two really cool algorithms, and I'm sure you've seen or heard of one or both of them, but one is this thing that generates images, and it's called DALL-E 2. You can give it text, you can describe an image that you want, and it'll actually generate an image. So you could say, I would like to see a cat flying over a mountain in the form of Picasso. And it'll do that, and it'll come up with these reasonable, surprisingly amazing images, and it'll do it near instantaneously, like within 5 to 10 seconds. And it gives you 4 different images. And it's free to use for up to a certain amount. They've just opened it up. OpenAI has just opened it up to anybody. And I don't know if you've heard about this, but what's been happening is people have been submitting images into art competitions. And because these are really good, like some of the images that come out are photorealistic, and you would not know that this was, and they're all original. Like there's nothing about this that's been done before. They're all original. And if you click reload, it'll come up with new images each time you do it. So here's a question. Is this art? I mean, it's novel. It's creative. It's done by an AI, though. It's not done by a human. What do you guys think about this idea of AI and generating art?
Well, a sub-question I think that's important here is it graphic art? Because graphic art is already kind of like a subset, right? It's not quite like painting. And my daughter came home on her first day of high school, grade 9, and her tech teacher, who was supposed to be teaching them Photoshop, basically showed them how to use this on the first day and said, there is no point for me to teach you how to use Photoshop. Because by the time any of you are in a career trying as graphic artists, if you go to college and do all this thing and like become a graphic artist, this is the tool you're going to be using now. You're not going to be using like the little icons and doodly dads on Photoshop to like put together this image that'll take you a week to do from scratch, where now an AI can do it for you. So yeah, it's a step in that direction, right? It is graphic art. And it has input from a human and aid from a computer. It's just that it's now a different mix, I guess, right, of how much the computer does for you and how the human interfaces, I guess, with that art.
I'm kind of floored that your daughter's graphics teacher said, don't even bother because AI is going to do it for you. That seems like they're kind of throwing up their arms and saying, I need not teach you any of this stuff. Because I got to imagine that there is a place for computer art, and then there's going to always be a place for human art. So I'm hoping that he's actually teaching them some other stuff as well.
What he did say was, this is going to be the new interface, right? Like it's, if you went to school to learn Photoshop, 4.0 15 years ago, you'd have learned a bunch of like icons and doodads and tools and how to use the computer to make images. And then if you had gone like 5 years ago and learned Photoshop 10 or whatever they're at, you'd be learning different kind of doodads and icons, and right, you're still being a graphic artist, but now your interface has changed and become upgraded and more sophisticated. And I think what he was suggesting is like, this is the future interface, right? Just the tool that you're using to make your graphic art is now going to include artificial intelligence and do a whole bunch of this, like, like the stuff that a graphic artist would spend like a week doing, fuzzing out this line or making this blend just right like that. You know, there's just going to be better tools for doing that faster. And I think this is the first one.
Yeah. I mean, like there's sort of two separate things. Like, is AI generated art art? And you can get your like Neo-Wittgensteinism on and say, well, if someone considers it art, it's art. And there you go. But I think And I think that's where the sort of crux of the debate is here. For me, back in an old life, I was a 3D into the 3D animation and Photoshop, and for me, it was just as much work to learn how to use the software as it was for me to apply my artistic ability using it within it. And if anything, it took it like Photoshop. I'm a huge fan of these digital images and digital art, because it takes so much of the grunt work out of illustration and you know, like just pencil a comic book or half a comic book and just think of, you know, how sore your hand is. Whereas you could draw an image up by hand and import it into Photoshop or Procreate or one of these pieces of software and get to the fun stuff a lot faster and actually free up space for creative input. You're not just like working on shading, working on the color, and all, you can actually just get to the meat of it. And actually, I think it empowers artists to make more interesting and take them further. And that's why you look at some of these 3D images, like they're incredible. But I think you'll always have different genres of art. We've always had different genres of art, and we have, you know, we have fine art. We have, and within that, you've got, you know, postmodernism and social realism and all of these different things. So I think what happens eventually is AI generated art that's generated solely by some sort of AR device becomes its own genre. And you can appreciate that for what it is, I think. And I think then also, as you know, these tools come for human artists or, you know, organically born artists. I don't know. We're going to have to work on that terminology. I think there's already different genres in that, you know, have different audiences to appreciate them, and so for me there's no problem. I think when people cross those genres in sort of a competition style, then you generate some great clickbait and you get people riled up and you get a debate that way. But I don't know that it's all that necessary. I think you can look at it. I could foresee a future where you have a very elegantly human created AI essentially that creates beautiful artwork, and there's something to appreciate there. And I think there's space for that, and it would just be its own type of space, just like, you know, graffiti is its own sort of space and has its own sort of set of judgments applied to it. So I think that's sort of where it goes. But I think it's easy to get caught up in the, you know, it's not a human didn't make it, so it can't possibly be art. Well, why not? Like, I mean, it's, you kind of, for me, I think it just opens up a different subgenre within a field that's pretty broad to begin with.
Well, then what if you started a corporation or somebody started a corporation on behalf of an AI that generates art and sends that art away to a third party to get printed and is drop shipped off to somebody, this corporation that is entirely automated could generate money. And it could even do automatic advertising through Facebook ads or Google AdSense. Now, you could imagine now a situation where you could have an entity unto itself that's able to monetize its own work, which would be pretty crazy.
Hmm. Oh, and to compete with that would be really difficult. That's a great point. Like if you're an artist without those sort of tools and abilities. Yeah.
The interesting thing about this story, Kevin, is it goes beyond art. Like you just said, you just created an AI can create its own shipping and monetizing its own product, which is hugely fascinating. So it's usually art that kind of advances these things too, though, isn't it? It's usually some form of art. And even to go back, we were talking briefly before about Da Vinci. That guy's art became inspirations for a lot of technology. So there's so many things to talk about when it comes to AI and art. Like, that's absolutely fascinating.
Well, it occurs to me that this debate is exactly the same as the question of whether photography is art, right? When realism was the goal of a painter, you want to capture the image as realistically as you can, right? Well, then photography came along and just actually captured a photograph. And now photography has become its own form of art, right? But it is a human eye that is providing the artistic composition and all of that, right? To balance it, you know, there's an art to photography. And that art is not just making something realistic. It is the composition of a picture to be pleasing to a human mind and an eye. So it seems to me that this AI generating, you know, any kind of art now, it's kind of the same thing. We've sort of given over the technical specializations to a computer to just do that, but it's still the human user that's going to create the composition using this, you know, this tool to make it art. Now, there will also be just like a single push button, right? Like, okay, now let's just let the AI do the whole thing. But presumably you'll probably get more interesting art if there's this feedback between the user and the software to sort of, you know, tweak the image until there's something about it that a human looks at it and is like, yeah, I really love that. That's just nice. And so it's like photography, right? It's still a human user that's going to create the art. It's just a better tool.
You don't need to have any special set of skills. You don't have to have any artistic skill apart from appreciation. You can enter keywords, and maybe that's part of the artistry. And then once it generates images, you could say, no, those four aren't very good. Generate again, generate again. And then that 11th one pops up. And if you can recognize that as being something that's going to emote, you know, emotions in people, I agree. That's a good point. I'd never thought of that. That's art. That is art. It's just a different kind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you still have realist painters and out there. And what you do is you end up appreciating the level of skill it takes to create something that could have been a photograph, or you don't appreciate because you're like, that could have just been a photograph. I think the core of the debate, it comes down to, is art a function of human expression or human appreciation? And if it's a matter of human appreciation, it doesn't really matter what generates the art. If you're more dogmatic and you feel that art is a function of human expression, then yeah, you're going to get your back up about, even, but it's, I mean, you're probably someone who doesn't like Photoshop, right? So but it's just a matter of what you appreciate. What genre of art can you, you know, calls out to you, right? And
but it's still human expression, yeah, just through another medium, right? Just like photography became another medium, now AI generated art is a medium. But somebody still has to, like, basically now the visual artist becomes a poet, right? Of putting together the right words to make a computer evoke the image that is artistically, you know, laudable or whatever. So it's still a human creating it, just with different tools.
Hey, can I read to you guys an AI-generated obituary? Marty,
yeah.
You've read this before, but I think it's just hilarious, and people might appreciate it.
Let's do it again. It is fantastic.
It is.
For those who are trying to visualize what these AIs can generate, this is from an algorithm called the GPT-3 algorithm by OpenAI, and it creates prose, like English or whatever language prose, based on text that it's been taught. And they asked it to write an obituary about a woman. And in this one, it reads like this. Brenda Tent retired from living at the age of old, surrounded by family and natural causes. A librarian from birth, Brenda was an avid collector of dust. She had a sweetheart and married her high school. She loved having hobbies and helping her sons to be disadvantaged youths. She had no horses, but thought she did. The church gave her a choir because she sang like bird and looked like bird, and Brenda was a bird. She owed us so many poems. The funeral will be held in 1977 at Heaven. In lieu of flowers, send Brenda more life.
Man, I love that.
You can't write better than that. And it's just, and that's all done by an AI.
But that's the thing. It's so wrong, right? It uses all the ingredients and it puts them together in this exactly hilariously wrong sequence, right? And so that's what makes me think that AI is ultimately going to be pretty stupid, right? It'll always be kind of like that, right? Where you train it up on this set, you know everything that goes into an obituary. It used all the words and all the phrases and all the sentiments, and it just put it together in this ridiculously wrong way, right? That anybody would know that is not a real obituary. And I wonder if that's, you know, that's going to be the...
But it's really funny. So it's entertaining and it's comedic. So is that like the equivalent of slapstick humor when someone hits their head on something and we laugh? Are we laughing at AI thinking like, you dummy? Like,
yeah, I think so.
But it's really funny. So it just created something actually very entertaining.
Well, in lieu of flowers, send Brenda more life. That's brilliant on any level.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, unbelievable.
Totally. And a human probably couldn't come up with that, right? Like, that's kind of the beauty of it too, right? Like,
I really would like to talk about some television and film if we want to go there. And we don't usually go too much into fantasy. I think we're going to talk more about fantasy in the future. I think that's something we should do, is have more conversations about some fantasy stuff, because there's more fantasy television lately. And one of those shows is The Rings of Power. The Lord of the Rings. The Rings of Power. There's a lot to unpack when we discuss a show like that. So I don't know how deep we want to go into what's going on with that show. But you guys have you guys been watching that? Have you kept up on the episodes that have come out?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, I got to say, I mean, I've been watching a lot of criticism and a lot of haters online, a lot of, you know, this sort of thing going on about it. I love this show. I think it's great. I mean, it's not brilliant. It's not genius. It's not the original Lord of the Rings, but it's really good fan fiction as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, fan fiction is great. I have no problem with people spending. I mean, if Jeff Bezos wants to spend $500 million making this show that's basically fan fiction of Lord of the Rings, and I get to live in that world for a little while and see the characters I love and get some backstory that's, like, I think great, even though it's cheesy sometimes, even though it's not perfect, even though, you know, all the criticism I see online is so petty. Like, so petty. Oh, did you see her face on the horse? She smiled wrong on that scene. Like, it, all this hate that's been piled on this now is, I think, just like...
The writing
is bad.
So bad.
Yeah, like,
All of a sudden, everyone is a professional, or I guess has a great understanding of what it takes to write something on television these days. It's, wonder, and I mean... I don't know if we want to go too much into the social commentary here, but I'm fascinated and maybe a little bit bothered, but I'm fascinated with what's going on social media when it comes to this show, because something's going on here. We have a show that's not that bad and it's getting bad reviews, like really bad reviews from the public. Like, it's getting worse reviews than like Miami Vice. You know, like, it's getting worse reviews than like some mystery thriller that come these new ones that come out and get canceled after every year.
I'm a big fan of the show. I'm a big fan of Lord of the Rings. I'm not embarrassed to say that I got a Lord of the Rings tattoo when I was 16, you know, so I'm a pretty big fan, and I think this show's fantastic. It fills in a story gap in that world that I want to know more about. And I think the writing is fantastic. I think people are upset and probably uncomfortable with the diversity of the cast. And I think that's what I think it comes down to. And I think anyone who's
familiar with
the canon...
It's a certain set of trolls that I think is upset about that, right? Like, I don't think most people are.
Ever wondered what it takes to make it in the movie business? Peel back the curtain with 4/6 Success Filmmaking. 4/6 Success Filmmaking is where filmmakers share their stories and the secrets.
It's beyond competitive out there.
There have been movies that it's taken me 10 years to get made.
Don't wait to create. Like, you've got to just keep making stuff.
Tune in to 4/6 Success Filmmaking for your dose of cinematic realness, direct from the voices that have lived it.
Yeah, the thing is, right-wing trolls tend to be the loudest, right? And so it makes it seem like there's this, you know, this outpouring, level of criticism. Really, I think anyone familiar with the canon and the Silmarillion or have any kind of passing familiarity with that isn't going to look at this and think that anything shocking has happened, apart from the Auroch Genesis story, that's pretty close. Like, it's close enough, right? There's nothing sideways here. You know, it's just people getting upset because there's people of color where they weren't expecting them or weren't used to them, and so they have a you know, triggers them into these right wing fits, and that's where they start getting mean and going, wow, look at this way she was riding the horse, or, you know, it's just ridiculous. It's our own set of orcs going after the show. That's my impression anyways. I haven't seen anyone give a reasonable critique of the show, and I think certainly episodes have shown that you can slowly build a story into something kind of awesome, and that's what they've been doing.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything that was a legitimate complaint. I keep on hearing bad writing, and I'm thinking, when did this start? When did all these trolls become really good critics of bad writing when there's just bad writing all over TV and people eat it up all the time? But I'm seeing a bit of a push here where I saw someone explain something on one of the social medias that said, it's when someone said, why are the racists coming out? Why are they all, like, what's the problem here? And what's happening now is people are sidestepping. The trolls are sidestepping, and they're saying it has nothing to do with the race of the actors. This is a terrible show. It has bad this. It has bad this. Bad costume design. Bad special effects. Bad everything. Do these people remember what happened a month and a half ago before it was even released? Like, it's been about 6 months to 8 months of them destroying and talking about how bad this is going to be. So you've got the same trolls that were talking for the last year about how bad the show is going to be and about how woke it is. Woke, woke, woke. They love saying that. Woke or go broke. They're all repeating the same thing because they can't think of anything new to say. And that's why they're now all repeating bad writing. But they're now saying it's not the color, it's actually really bad. But do you remember what you've been saying for the past year before the show even came out? You were talking about how terrible it's going to be.
We also like to complain. You know, we've talked about this before, that we just expect everything to be so unbelievably amazing. And this is amazing. Like, this is a really good show. And anybody who says the special effects are poor just simply are not paying attention, or they're really not able to. Their confirmation bias is making it so hard for them to see what's actually in front of them. I can't really speak to the writing. I like to think I'm fairly knowledgeable about writing, and I think it's okay. I think it's fine. I really enjoy it. We also have to remember that this is written for a younger audience. Like, it's not Game of Thrones. It's intended to be accessible to younger audiences as well as older audiences. So that limits what you can do as a writer. What's also noteworthy is if you look at the writing, the reviews of this show, there's no middle ground. I'm looking at a review right now on Google, and there's 19,000 ratings for this. By far, the majority of people are rating it as a 5 out of 5, and the second largest cohort, probably about 90% of the people who rated as 5, rated as a 1. And then there's these tiny subset of people who rated as a 2, 3, or a 4. So this is a weirdly polarizing show for some reason, and I suspect it's probably what you guys are saying.
Oh yeah, these people aren't actually evaluating the show. They're just voicing, you know, a toxic sort of opinion, I think, right, that they have about everything. And this show is pushing their buttons to come out and say what they always say. And honestly, who cares? I mean, I'm so done with these people. They're not knowledgeable. They're not informed. And in fact, when they say, oh, it's bad special effects, that's when you know that this is basically like, you know, what Trump does. He just doubles down on saying the opposite of whatever is real, right? Like, he's going to say that he's the greatest entrepreneur in the world, and he's going to say that, you know, Biden is the worst person in the human history. Like, it's just picking an extreme, you know, point of view that's honestly opposite to reality most of the time, and saying it because it is opposite, right? Just because they can. I'm like, I'm going to say this completely outrageous, non-true thing because I can, and a whole bunch of other people are going to say it as well, and that's going to make it true. And like, that's enough, man. I'm just done with that. I don't want to hear it anymore. I'm not interested in it. There's nothing to be gained by listening to the evaluation of like a show that has spectacular special effects, you know, to have some guy be like, oh, the effects are bad. Like, oh, come on. Like, shut up. I want to talk about the latest episode. I want to talk about episode 6. I could see things going this way and that way for the first 5 episodes, you know, that there was some better parts, there were some worse parts. I could see how people might not be think that it's the greatest show in the world. But that 6th episode, man, I think it was the 6th one, right? The latest from now. That was amazing. That episode did so much. Like, it packed so many different things and layers and everything that's what I, when I got convinced this is good writing, this was a slow build. It was weaving certain things, putting things in place so that they could have this spectacular episode where things came together. So much was done. The effects were great. The writing, the characters, the plot suddenly matured. You know, I thought it was a work of art, maybe not a work of genius, but definitely a work of like really amazing film art. So yeah, go. I mean, I'm surprised even. I think maybe I didn't expect it, but that latest episode really convinced me that this is a truly excellent work. And I, of course, watching Game of Thrones at the same time. I think that's part of what's going on here too, right? That there is this two different kinds of fantasies or subgenres competing against each other. And where Game of Thrones goes for shocking violence and extreme, you know, lately sexual pushing buttons and stuff, like the incest, like, you know, Game of Thrones has always been sort of trying to get people in by shocking them. There was like I thought the Lord of the Rings did something really classy, really made its own, carved out its own turf, let's say, artistically, in that they presented something kind of genuinely new and engaging and surprising in its own way without having to just be sort of cheap violence. It was not cheap, I thought. I thought it really outdid Game of Thrones recently, at least in terms of class.
Yeah, significantly less incest as well. So, yeah.
So we read The Apollo Murders by Chris Hadfield in the last month. Actually, it's probably been 3 months or so since we assigned this book, or two at least. This is, the first fictional offering by Canada's famous astronaut, Chris Hadfield. He's written some nonfiction books. He's done a tremendous amount in his career as an astronaut, his video of Space Oddity, is that what it's called? On the guitar while actually playing it in space, but many other things. Anyway, so he wrote a book. He wrote a sci-fi book. And it's really more of an alternative history, I'd say, right? It's an alternative history slash thriller in the style of a science fiction book. I'm kind of surprised you guys did. Well, we'll see what everybody thought. I'm surprised, Tristan, you didn't like it. I was trying to offer something less poetic and mystical and just something a little more mainstream.
I just figured grocery store.
Oh, come on. no, but it got a lot of attention in marketing. It was, you know, in the front of your bookstore whenever it came out, I'm sure. It cost $36 or something for the hardcover. So, I mean, there's no, clearly they think there's a market for this. So it was no Neverness, that's for sure. And but it was I thought it was kind of similar actually to Jim Al Khalili's book, which I did enjoy as well, The Sunfall. Alternative history of the space race. I thought it was interesting because we were just talking about TV, the best show on TV right now, even better than The Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, is For All Mankind. Everybody needs to watch this show. It's getting better and better. It's so amazing. And it's kind of the same plot and same story that's being told in Chris Hadfield's book here. It's an alternative history. The question it asks is, you know, what if the Apollo program didn't really stop? What if there were military applications to the space program that we never heard about? What if there were Russians on the moon as well as Americans, and you were never told about it? And For me, the reason that's interesting is because it's absolutely 100% not just plausible, but almost for sure in my mind. I mean, why would governments tell you everything they do? Why would, you know, NASA not also have side projects that are not meant for public public scrutiny? There are lots of reasons to keep the public away from lots of the stories that I'm sure happened in space. So I love the fact that there was an astronaut, a real guy who's actually been there, knows a lot of the players. He's worked with Russians. He's worked with the Canadians, Americans. He's been part of the space program for, 40 years or something. And so I like to think that he's sort of teasing us out a little bit of you know, a story that was true that we never heard about.
Honestly, I went through this knowing the source. And, you know, this, like you said, he's a colonel in the military, and he's been with NASA for years and years, and he's been the crew leader of ISS, International Space Station. So this gentleman knows a lot about rocketry, about astronauting, if that's a verb, I'm not sure if it is. And so the source lent a lot of credibility to a story that already seemed really real. And so his knowledge about the Apollo missions, even though they weren't firsthand, were pretty close as far as firsthandedness goes to the 1970s Apollo missions. And he said right at the beginning, you know, many of the characters are real. Many of these events actually happened. And then at the end, he has this list of all the real people and explanations. And for those of us who kind of like that, it felt very authentic. And like you said, it's sort of like an alternative history that could very well have happened. And he does go into a lot of details about the processes. And for those of us who are kind of space nerds, I think that's something that really strikes a chord and adds to the authenticity. I liked it. I really liked it. There were a couple things that I did quibble about, like the antagonist that I won't talk too much about. I kind of felt like there was some... I didn't believe his character. I didn't think that it was written in a way that made me believe it. But apart his behaviors and such. But apart from that, I really enjoyed it. I got through it fairly quickly, and I would recommend it to other sci-fi nerds. Or anybody who's really interested in space stuff. That would be my recommendation.
Awesome. Good. Glad. And I think you're right. You know, in retrospect, thinking about that, the villain was a little bit. He was a bit cardboard cutout, but I'm willing to forgive that little bit for all the other authenticity and everything else that he brought to this book.
I thought this book was like Tom Clancy wrote an engineering manual from the set of the movie The Right Stuff. Just to say, good, it was good. A bit stiff, and the characters were fairly two-dimensional. I mean, there's a scene where the protagonist is courting a woman with his acoustic guitar and singing a song. That only works in the real world if you're a fighter pilot. And the woman is keeping her focus on the fact that you're a fighter pilot and ignoring the acoustic guitar. These are not dating tips for the everyday man. You know,
really?
This is astronaut. BS.
But he was a fighter pilot.
That's just it. What we learned about Chris Hadfield is that he was able to like get with women with his acoustic guitar, thinking it was the acoustic guitar. Sorry, Chris, but they were really working their darndest to ignore the guitar and were focused on the fact that you fly an F-18 or the space shuttle. So, I mean, overall, it was okay. And it's actually kind of remarkable considering that it's a side gig for him. So, you know, I've certainly read worst and from more widely published sci-fi authors, but I don't see myself reading any more of his work. It was a bit dry at times. I'm not that big of a space science geek, like all the launch procedures and all that. Like, it was kind of interesting, and then it would get uninteresting after a bit. But I get that's where he's, you know, I mean, it's written by a test pilot. Like, it's written like a manual almost. And it's lacks a bit of heart is what I was looking for. It's sort of an intangible thing that I don't think was that he quite achieved. But I mean, you know, a very good book considering that, like, he's not a writer by trade. He's just, you know, now it's his, he's, you know, accomplished fantastic things, and now he can, you know, show that he's actually got, you know, he can write a book. But yeah, not one. I was happy to be done with it, personally.
I don't think it was a horrible book at all. Like, it's not. It's actually an accomplishment that Chris Hadfield made this book. Like, he's not an author by trade, as Sam said, and he's an astronaut. And my first exposure to his work was seeing the video that you mentioned, Kevin, which was the Space Odyssey. Space Oddity, which is a David Bowie song. And I remember seeing that and being, oh, we got a Canadian guy who's that nerdy dad that you're embarrassed by with a big ass. His mustache is phenomenal. Like, it's thick, it's well trimmed, and no one's mentioned that yet. Gorgeous mustache on that man.
Great mustache. Great.
Amazing. Mustache. But comparing it to Tom Clancy, that's okay. Like, it's, and we don't read Tom Clancy books in this group, at least not yet. Maybe we're going to start getting into that more often. I don't know. We'll see what Marty's got for us next time. But for me, it felt like, and I've read Seven Eves. Something about it really reminded me of Seven Eves, which is Neal Stephenson. It was like a Neal Stephenson book without the really in-depth tangents that are extremely entertaining. I've read a few Stephenson, and yeah, it just reminded, it was almost like he was trying to, he probably reads Stephenson. He's probably read Seventies and Cryptonomicon, and I don't know. I'm just assuming that he has. If you're an aspiring writer, you would read the best of that class, and Stephenson would be. So I found it to be, yeah, just short of what Stephenson accomplishes. But Stephenson is very brave, and he can go on long tangents about how a simple device works in space and knows the details, but his descriptions keep you intrigued. Though I felt like I was learning and reading a bit of a textbook at times with this Hadfield book. It was entertaining, but yeah, then you get a little bit like, okay, so let's get further. Yeah, and the characters, totally uninterested in all of them. Main character, I felt like his biggest, I guess, just something that set him apart in the books was simply just that he had one eye. Like, that was his biggest character trait. And that's not even a character trait, but it was almost as if that was used as like, hey, this guy's got the, like, I don't know. I didn't, there was nothing that really, I didn't appreciate any of the characters, and it was very two-dimensional, as Sam said, where I didn't get behind the characters. Even when there were accidents and deaths that happened, I was like, okay, like, I'm watching an action movie here or reading an action thriller. So the adventure wasn't there with me, for me. I wanted to go on an adventure. I was hoping that this would kind of do that. At the same time, I just found it more of a historical fiction that just happened to be based in space, written by a guy who was an astronaut, so was able to write that because he knows it. But it was more of a historical fiction for me. It wasn't it definitely wasn't a space opera. It's not a science fiction in terms of having new ideas. These were all old ideas with a bit of a twist. And I like old stuff like that. I like the 60s and the 70s. I like reading stuff about that era, but just this, it was a bit stiff, to be honest. However, it's an accomplishment that he wrote this. Like, there are certain sentences and words that he said that were like, oh, good, nice. Like, that was great. But consistently through the whole book, not really. And then just my attention for staying to the end, which I barely got to, was good.
This is like complimenting an actor after they get off the stage by saying, wow, it's really amazing that you memorized all those words.
I'm sorry for that. Like, I mean, we'd love to get Chris on the show and talk to him, and if he heard all this, he would be like, well, I'll come, but only if Marty and Kevin are there. Don't have that Sam and Tristan there at all. Which is fine, but I mean, we Well, I'm just being honest here.
No, like, no.
I hope I'm not too trolly. It just wasn't my kind of thing. I don't really read historical fiction thrillers. And I have before and tried to do it. You know what? Maybe I'll go grab a Clive Cussler book and see how it holds up.
So I agree. I mean, you know, it's not our job to pat Chris Hadfield on the back for managing to write a book. I mean, obviously nobody's going to read that book on that recommendation. So this is certainly a specific style of science fiction. And if we're going to recommend it to somebody, like Kevin said, like the space nerds will love it, space tech nerds. Yeah. And, you know, it's not the greatest piece of literature ever written or even the best thriller. But for me, what I found interesting, and I think what is interesting to people in this book, is there are certain historical facts, okay, that we don't know the full story to. And so he takes those historical facts and he sort of presents them to you and then writes in this probably mostly fictional backstory and like how to account for that. And that being, you know, the one of the main ones is there was a Russian satellite, you know, one of the very first spy satellites ever put up, you know, was a Russian satellite. They had a gun on that satellite. They fired that gun. They really did, and the gun, malfunctioned and totally, you know, knocked the satellite out of orbit, and it burned up in the atmosphere. So that really happened, and I just want to know more, right? Like, there's a whole lot to that story, I'm sure. Why did they fire that gun? Well, I mean, maybe it was just a test. I'm sure the story we got, right? So I think it's just cool, right? It is a certain subgenre of sci-fi to, like, present this like, framework of something that really happened in the world that's probably a really interesting story, and maybe we'll never know the truth about what happened and why. And then, you know, give us some adventure. Write it in for us, because it's just really interesting. So
I think that plausibility is what really makes this is a well done story. You know, regardless of what we say about the characters, et cetera, which I don't disagree with, some of that is the plausibility of it is pretty cool. And like the fact that there existed this potential intrigue and Cold War drama. Of course, there was Cold War drama in the Apollo missions, but we don't hear much about it. You know, we know that there was a space race to get to the moon, but well, what else? And here is a really interesting, plausible story of what else could have happened. And so, yeah, it really does read like an alternative history or even a history that we don't know about.
All right. Well, I think we have to leave it to Sam to like move us on now. Move us forward past this dark chapter in our book recommending history.
See what I can do here, guys. All right. So coming up next on the reading list, we've got Martha Wells, the Murder Bot series. So Martha's coming on the show, and I thought, and I've just finished reading all these books, and I loved it. And so we're back in a fun sci-fi here. So,
awesome.
The Murder Bot series is fun, and guys, I know there's it's made up of novellas and a few novels. So I'm going to leave it to you to, if you read one or two novellas, you'll be able to talk to it. So whatever you feel like picking up and reading, go for it. So it's not one specific book. I think we've got there's quite a few in the series right now, something like 6 to 8 books. And so pick your fave, pick the wherever you left off, read the next one, or start from the first novella. You could probably read the first two pretty quickly. And it's at, you know, at first glance you figure, well, it's just like, it's an AI driven friendly Terminator movie, you know, a super soldier can, you know, knock down anything and all that kind of stuff. But when you read these books, you realize that movies like the Terminator and the movies that or books that talk to AI and the threat of AI are too simplistic. And I think what Martha Wells does really well here is to create this AI character that serves as a very elegant demonstration, is really well written, as a demo of the multiple processes that are possible for an AI to maintain with the same focus that we as humans can only devote to one process at a time. And so sometimes the writing is a little difficult because your main character is an AI who can do 5 different things or 12 different things at once. And so she weaves that really well into the story and to into a readable story that really had an impact on me as I was reading. And the AI characters kind of sardonic and funny and you know, there's a good dose of sarcasm. So the character becomes quite lovable and you're rooting for the character, but then you're reminded every now and again, the character doesn't have feelings. And this character is, you know, can do 15 things at once and all these things and how its thought processes weave through that. So for me, these were sort of really interesting themes that I think she did a great job with. And in the world that these books are planted in, and there's is really interesting as well. There's corporate space and then there's sort of free space. And so you have different systems and they're either corporate aligned or unaligned. And if we were to picture the corporate occupation of space, your next step is to realize that you're probably looking at the future of slave labor. Because when you get out into deep space, probably the first department that the corporation's going to cut is going to be the HR department. So it's, I think, an interesting potential prediction of the conditions that we might see in the future. You know, we see billionaires move their companies into space and eventually beyond the reach of their home governments. You know, we can probably predict pretty fairly awful worker conditions in our space-faring future, and we have to wonder what happens when a company occupies a planet versus a nation, or how that works. And I know there's space law is a thing, and I'd love to have someone with that sort of background speak to that. But anyways, there's elements of that within the world. So there's a lot to sort of dine out on here. And I think it'll be a fun read as we go into head into the fall here.
Oh, it's super exciting. I loved this series. I read all of them and I'm happy to read them again. Not only that, you mentioned they were award-winning, but are they ever award-winning? Holy man. The first two novellas both won Hugo's for Best Novella. The first one, All Systems Red, won the Nebula and the Hugo for Best Novella. And the fifth in the series, which was her first full novel in this series, won the Nebula Award and the Hugo Award for Best Novel. So very many awards put on this series.
Well, guys, I do have a bit of trivia. It's a truncated trivia session tonight, if you guys are game. All right, and it's Hadfield trivia. It's just to, you know, in honor of
what
our 50% appreciated author. Yeah. So let's test your Chris knowledge here. Where was Hadfield born?
Sarnia.
Winnipeg.
Winnipeg. Yes.
Sarnia.
Oh, Sarnia.
Sarnia. Oh. Wow. Yeah.
One
I
for Kevin.
Because I went to high school in Sarnia, and the airport, the local airport, was named after Colonel Chris Hadfield.
Wow.
Very well, cool. When was the Colonel's first mission? What year?
1992.
2001.
We got a 1992. You're close.
1995.
Close and you're middle. In. 1995. Yep.
Oh, hey, there we go.
And so he was the first Canadian to visit what space station?
Mir.
The ISS?
Mir. Mir. That's two for Marty.
Ooh,
he was the only Canadian to visit Mir. And he was the first Canadian to what in space?
Play guitar.
Fornicate.
He did play guitar. He was actually the first Canadian to play guitar in space. I should have. Yes, we'll give that to you. He was also the first to free float in space. Tristan's on the board with one here. And
so wait,
how
what's
many
free
trips
float?
Did he what? Make to space?
Oh. Eight.
I guess he got to put on a jetpack and like puff his way around and
untethered.
And how many times did he go up? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I didn't put a lot of effort in our trivia tonight. I don't know if it's showing, but it reflects my enthusiasm for his book. How many times was he in space?
Nine.
I'm going to revise my answer to four.
No.
7.
Marty, you're close. He was in base 3 times. His last trip was in 2013. But he did work in mission control for an additional 25 missions. So he was the guy in the chair for a lot of his so. Well, Marty takes the cake tonight. You win no prize because I didn't get my act together to find something weird on Facebook. So, Marty, I have no prize for you. I'll buy you a beer.
Maybe you can get me a gift card to a grocery store, and I'll go and buy the next Chris Hadfield book there.
Yeah. I think they have it at Shoppers Drug Mart too. So that's not. I mean, it's kind of a grocery store, but it's kind of a pharmacy and a cosmetic store. So Shoppers will have it too, Marty.
All right.
Phew.
Well, that was an interesting episode. We complained about trolls and then became orcs ourselves. Sam, I can't believe you said all that about Chris Hadfield's book. Next episode, Jamie Anderson, son of Jerry Anderson, creator of Thunderbirds, creator of Space 1999, joins us. We talk about all the cool stuff with those retro shows. I love that stuff. Jamie's awesome. Join us for that. Thanks for joining us today. Until next time.